This is Free Speech Radio News for Monday, June 7, 2004. Former U.S. President Ronald Reagan died on Saturday. Today we look at his legacy. Minnesota senior citizens file a federal lawsuit alleging antitrust violations by pharmaceutical giants. And a juvenile detention center in Louisiana that was notorious for prison abuse finally closes its doors. But first, these news headlines.
From KPFT in Houston, I'm Randy Zimmerman with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Pentagon officials argued that torture is a legitimate form of interrogation under presidential orders. In a document reported by the Wall Street Journal today, Selena Masuda reports from the D.C. Co-op.
According to the Wall Street Journal, at the core of an internal classified Pentagon report that was slated to be publicly released in 2013 stated that definitions of torture do not apply if intelligence can be gathered, quote, to the protection of untold thousands of American citizens, end quote. This report was drafted for Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld by military and civilian lawyers after commanders in late 2002 at Guantanamo Bay complained that current methods of interrogation did not lead to substantial intelligence information. The draft report focused on legal loopholes that would essentially ignore legislation forbidding torture, such as the 1984 United Nations Convention Against Torture, which was ratified by the U.S. in 1994. It states that no exceptional circumstances whatsoever, whether a state of war or a threat of war, internal political instability, or any other public emergency may be invoked as a justification of torture. It is not clear if President Bush has seen that draft report. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Selena Masuta of the D.C. Radio Co-op.
Today, the U.S. Supreme Court chose to support an international trade agreement instead of the environment. Amarutha Nanjappa explains from D.C.
The Supreme Court ruled unanimously today that the Bush administration can open roads to Mexican trucks without conducting an extensive environmental study. In November 2002, President Bush said that Mexican trucks should be allowed on roads throughout the country in order to comply with NAFTA provisions. This ended a 1982 moratorium, which limited Mexican trucks to operating only in narrow border zones. Bush's decision was opposed by consumer group Public Citizen, the Teamsters Union, and others who sued the Department of Transportation on environmental and safety grounds. David Bookbinder, the Washington legal director of the Sierra Club, discussed the negative implications of today's decision.
There's going to be no environmental study and no environmental action taken to decrease the amount of pollution that will be contributed by the fleet of Mexican trucks that are now going to be operating.
Environmental groups claim that the federal government underestimated the impact older diesel Mexican trucks, which emit twice as many pollutants as U.S. trucks, have on air quality. For Free Speech Radio News in Washington, D.C., this is Amrutha Nanjappa.
Poor people face higher prices for food items when they go to their neighborhood stores with federal vouchers, according to a newspaper study. Gail Walker reports from WBAI in New York.
According to government officials, there's been an increase in the number of smaller grocery stores that accept only government vouchers and sell only to WIC families. The government says these stores are charging higher prices than larger retail stores like Walmart and claims the higher costs mean less people will be able to use the service. Some WIC-only store managers say their prices are slightly higher than larger retail shops because their costs are higher and because, unlike larger outlets, they cannot negotiate directly with manufacturers. Some WIC-only store managers say their shops are popular because they offer convenience and better service, and it appears that some WIC customers agree. WIC client Lucinda Garson says she uses a WIC-only store in her neighborhood to make WIC purchases because she can't afford to pay to transport her groceries from the larger stores outside of her neighborhood. According to the New York Times, some lawmakers are considering legislation to limit prices at the WIC-only stores. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Gail Walker.
Senators proposed a bill that could change the landscape of U.S. radio in favor of grassroots broadcasters. Dante Toza has more from Radio Volta.
Senator John McCain introduced the Low Power Radio Act of 2004 late last week. The act calls to repeal the law set in 2001, which heavily restricted the licensing for low-power radio, also known as LPFM. The act is a result of a formal recommendation made to Congress by the FCC this past February, after reports showed that interference claims made against LPFM are unsubstantiated. The chairman of the National Association of Broadcasters, which represents the interests of corporate media giants, claims the study is, quote, deeply flawed, unquote. NAB fought hard with the FCC to get the study done and cost taxpayers over $2 million. Hannah Sessman from the Prometheus Radio Projects, a group that heavily lobbies for the rights of LPFM broadcasters, says, now is the time to call your senators. Tell them how much you love community radio and that you want them to support the S-2505, the bill that will bring thousands more low-power FM radio stations to communities across America. For FSRN, this is Dante Toza from Philadelphia.
And I'm Randy Zimmerman for Free Speech Radio News.
President Ronald Reagan died on Saturday at the age of 93. Reagan's plight with Alzheimer's brought the once little-talked-about disease to the forefront of national attention. The disease galvanized his wife Nancy Reagan to break from conservative thought and ardently support stem cell research, science that could lead to a cure for Alzheimer's and other diseases. Tributes to Reagan have been made from around the world, and many U.S. media outlets are calling him one of the greatest presidents of our time. Reagan is remembered as the president who helped end the Cold War and who beefed up military spending while cutting taxes and social programs. Our D.C. editor, Mitch Jezerich, looks at the policies of the Reagan administration throughout the 80s.
President Ronald Reagan's nationwide funeral ceremonies will be the most elaborate seen in over 30 years. Reagan is being remembered by current and former U.S. lawmakers and media as the man who saved the world. Many credit Reagan's political will in outspending the Soviet Union on the military as key in the U.S. victory of the Cold War without having fired a single shot.
My fellow Americans, I'm pleased to tell you today that I've signed legislation that will outlaw Russia forever. We begin bombing in 5 minutes.
However, under Reagan, many U.S. bullets and money for weapons were fired around the world in the name of defeating communism. Reagan authorized billions of dollars to right-wing governments and paramilitaries in the Central America to quash Marxist insurgents, who were primarily poor and indigenous peoples. In his first year in office, he increased military aid to the right-wing El Salvadorian government by $65 million. After reports of an El Salvadorian government massacre of peasants in several villages, Congress passed a bill in 1983 to curb military aid to that country, but Reagan vetoed it. Reagan's foreign policy also included the support of the apartheid regime of South Africa. Bill Fletcher, president of the Trans-Africa Forum, says Reagan's support of the South Africa's apartheid regime helped destabilize the rest of the region.
It permitted South Africa to continue to engage in military operations in both Angola and Mozambique, and in both cases obstructed the ability of those countries to pursue constructive paths of economic development. So not only was the South African government permitted to conduct or carry out a continuation of white minority rule, but they were permitted to destabilize other countries, all in the name of prosecuting the Cold War.
Reagan is also being remembered for the way he dramatically increased spending on the military, cut taxes, and cut social service programs. In his second year in office, Reagan proposed cutting $9 billion in support programs for children and families, of which Congress approved only $1 billion. Under Reagan, mental hospitals were closed without providing community support services, food stamp programs were cut, and education was cut, including lunch programs for the poor.
Ronald Reagan was the man who made being a liberal, quote, a bad thing, a bad word.
Though Reagan's signature did turn Martin Luther King Day into a federal holiday, Loretta Ross, executive director for the Center for Human Rights Education in Atlanta, Georgia, says Reagan worked against civil rights for many people.
He was the face that the moral majority wanted to put on their segregationist policies, their pro-war policies, their anti-women policies, their anti-gay policies. But because he was such a persuasive actor, people were charmed, or some people were charmed by his, quote, skills as a great communicator, and they didn't lift up the skirts to see what was under there.
HIV/AIDS began spreading like wildfire throughout the country, beginning with Reagan's first term in office. However, Reagan never publicly said the word AIDS until the seventh year of the presidency. Mark Milano is an HIV/AIDS activist who has been living with the disease since 1981.
When I think of Ronald Reagan and AIDS, I think of what ACT UP said during the 80s, which is genocide. Ronald Reagan deliberately and purposefully ignored this disease because it initially affected mainly gay men and IV drug users. And it was clear from his willful refusal to do literally anything about this illness that he was not concerned about that population. Ronald Reagan refused to address it and did not even speak the word AIDS publicly until 7 years into his administration. That kind of willful denial is immoral and unconscionable, and I shed no tear at his death because he is completely responsible for the deaths of millions around the world.
Mitch Jezrich, Free Speech Radio News.
Former President Jimmy Carter has a new namesake, the country's newest, most high-tech, nuclear-powered fast-attack submarine. Carter attended the sub's christening ceremony Saturday in Groton, Connecticut. As 1,000 invited guests walked through the security gates, they were greeted by protesters who show up at every ceremony celebrating these multi-billion dollar weapons of war. But the demonstrators were particularly angry about this one. Melinda Tuhus reports.
Jimmy Carter is America's most active and visible ex-president. Through his other namesake institution, the Carter Center, he has promoted negotiated settlements to countless conflicts. In 2002, he won the Nobel Peace Prize for his many contributions to peace. But in addition to his roles as president and peacemaker, Carter was also a nuclear engineer and a naval officer who is the only U.S. president trained in submarine warfare. So in many ways, naming the $5 billion sub after him is a perfect fit. The Navy band played for the guests who sat on a platform with a good view of the 450-foot sub, which includes a one-of-a-kind hull to support classified research, tactical undersea surveillance, and undersea warfare. Meanwhile, Connecticut peace activists protested outside the gates, criticizing Carter for allowing his name to be attached to this most sophisticated of warships. Stephen Cobesa of New Haven called it a terrible irony.
When he has been so public about calling for peaceful negotiation as a way of resolving conflict, and just a year ago wrote in the New York Times a very powerful column in which he condemned the current policy of the United States government, you know, operating independently of any other kind of world opinion or concern. So I can't imagine what policy he thinks this vessel is going to be used for.
Six activists were arrested and charged with disorderly conduct or obstructing free passage when they walked out from behind the barricades where police had restricted them and tried to approach guests with the call to turn swords into plowshares. Back at the ceremony, Carter's wife, Rosalind, broke a bottle of champagne against the bow of the ship, christening it the Jimmy Carter. At the General Dynamics Shipyard in Groton, Connecticut, I'm Melinda Tuhus for FSRN.
As the leaders of the world's eight largest industrialized nations converge on Sea Island, Georgia for the G8 summit, the surrounding community of Brunswick is dealing with environmental racism. Free Speech Radio News correspondent Ara Bogado reports.
It's impossible to escape the stench of toxic waste in Brunswick. Liquids and fumes from various factories are leached into the air and water daily, contributing to one of the highest cancer rates in the country. Meanwhile, a short distance from the Atlantic sits the tiny, 5-mile-long Sea Island, known as a pristine resort with $500-a-night hotel suites, where the G8 is set to meet for a 3-day summit starting tomorrow. Daniel Parshley is the project manager for the Glen Environmental Coalition. He says the quality of life on the mainland is very different.
There is a great disparity between the Sea Islands and Brunswick. Whereas the Brunswick Peninsula is ringed by Superfund sites, we can't eat the seafood, and we're struggling just to get the laws meant to protect everyone to protect us.
The Superfund sites partially refers to are part of a federal program to clean up historically toxic sites. Robert Randall is an activist from Brunswick. He describes a couple of nearly 24 sites in the small county.
One of the sites was a manufacturing facility that used a mercury process to make chlorine. The chlorine then went next door to the paper mill and was used in a bleaching process for paper and for other things too. One of the sites is an old dump site where the Hercules Corporation, which made a pesticide called toxaphene here at their plant, took all the sludge and dumped it in basically an open landfill pit.
Brunswick County is 60% African American. The systemic practice of dumping chemicals and burning toxic fumes in communities of color is not surprising to people that are familiar with the history of Georgia, whose current state flag dons the Confederate flag of the pre-Civil War era. George Friday is on the steering committee for United for Peace and Justice. She says that what she sees in Brunswick is typical of the South, wealthy white communities next to poor black ones.
In communities where there are people who don't have the resources to say, no, you can't do that to me, because of lack of education and lack of wealth, you wind up having environmental conditions that are so unsafe, that are so toxic. You can't even take a deep breath. For the folks who live in Sea Island, it's like a refuge from the reality of the conditions they've created. Because the profits that built their houses and fill their bank accounts are the profits these people who can't take a deep breath in their own community created.
Reporting from the Independent Media Center in Brunswick, Georgia, I'm Aura Bogado for Free Speech Radio News.
Last week, residents of a rural Mississippi Delta town joined families and friends of Louisiana's incarcerated children to celebrate the closure of a youth detention center that made their town's name synonymous with prison abuse. At the same time, they promised to keep fighting to improve their community by turning the notorious facility into an educational center. Renee Feltz files this report from Tallulah, Louisiana.
With a Louisiana crawfish boil and catfish fry, supporters of children formerly imprisoned at the Swanson Correctional Center for Youth celebrated its closure last week, 6 months ahead of schedule.
I see this as a big victory. I wouldn't have missed being here to see this today.
Daisy Mae Metz's grandson served time at the center in Tallulah.
It was something that I wouldn't actually ask no one child to go through. It was just heartbreaking for the family, heartbreaking for the child, and everyone in the community of what the child experienced.
In the mid-1990s, investigations into the Tallulah facility by Human Rights Watch and the U.S. Department of Justice documented deplorable conditions. Young prisoners filed a flood of complaints about violence by guards and between inmates. An appeals court in 2002 ruled conditions of confinement at Tallulah were unconstitutional, and a judge ordered the Louisiana Department of Corrections to relocate youths held there to other facilities by the end of the year. Still, closing the jail has meant losing jobs badly needed in the area. Moses J. Williams of the Louisiana Delta Coalition for Education and Economic Development points to a plan to use the property as an educational center.
Closing the juvenile facility presents an opportunity for us. Rather than the negative publicity they brought to the community, we now have a chance to generate some positive publicity. In fact, if we are able to create the learning center here in this community, it can be the first time in this country that such a facility has been converted to an education complex. And we would be a model for not only the state of Louisiana, but for the nation.
A lawmaker from the Tallulah area, State Senator C.D. Jones, describes legislation he's introduced that would convert Swanson Correctional Facility into an educational center. This week, he plans to present the bill to the State Appropriations Committee.
The bill 785 creates the Northeast Louisiana Delta Learning Center, which includes the merger of the two high schools, the Vocational Technical School, Community College, as well as college courses offered by a four-year institution. When it comes to full fruition, it will create around 600-700 jobs. It will provide the economic engine as well as the attraction that industry looks to locate in a region, particularly the lower Mississippi Delta, which is the poorest region of the United States.
Meanwhile, as this legislation is considered, state officials have moved forward with plans laid out in the 2005 prison budget to use the facility to house third and fourth time drunk driver offenders and low-level drug offenders.
They are smarter than we are, and that's not the case.
The two-thirds of the staff that will keep their jobs at the site underwent training last week to work with adult inmates. Prison system spokeswoman Pamela Ford.
We are just operating under the mandate that we have now is to turn it into an adult facility, and that's what we're going to go ahead and do. And if it's in 3 weeks or if it's next year that the legislature or somewhere down the road decides they want to turn this facility into something else, then we'll have to adjust our plans at that time.
Still, family members and residents of Tallulah believe other changes at the center, like a new sign and guard towers, don't mean their plan for an educational center is hopeless.
I ain't gonna let nobody turn us around.
They keep a positive attitude while lobbying lawmakers and working with an architectural firm on inexpensive redesign plans.
And against the razor wire backdrop of the now closed youth detention center, last week young people carried out a mock graduation ceremony of the potential educational center's first graduates. In the Mississippi Delta town of Tallulah, Louisiana, I'm Renee Feltz for Free Speech Radio News.
When New Hampshire Senator Judd Gregg introduced legislation last week that would allow importation of prescription drugs from Canada, he became the third GOP committee chairman pressing to open U.S. borders to circumvent high, unregulated drug prices. Despite disapproval from the Bush administration, such efforts are beginning to make headway both on and off Capitol Hill. A federal lawsuit recently launched in Minnesota is the first of its kind to directly address alleged antitrust practices by nine pharmaceutical giants. From Minneapolis, Kristen Lerstrom and Carrie Byron have the story.
The suit was filed May 19th in Minneapolis on behalf of the Minnesota Senior Federation. Judge John Tunheim's first ruling will decide whether the case will be awarded federal class action status. Attorney Marv Miller is representing the Minnesota Senior Federation.
It's an attempt to open up the competitive markets so that American citizens do not continue to pay 20 to 80% more than their Canadian counterparts for pharmaceuticals.
The suit names nine pharmaceutical companies, including Pfizer, Merck, and GlaxoSmithKline, alleging that they conspired to keep U.S. drug prices artificially high by limiting supplies to Canadian pharmacies selling drugs to Americans. Peter Wyckoff, executive director of the Metropolitan Region Minnesota Senior Federation, says that even though Canadian and U.S. pharmacies stock many of the same drugs, there has long been a price differential between the two markets.
Canada, like the rest of the industrialized world, puts the needs of its citizens ahead of the profiteering of international pharmaceutical companies.
Wyckoff says that Pfizer began a new tactic of cutting off supplies of pharmaceutical drugs to Canadian wholesalers who may have been selling to American consumers.
Pfizer did this, and I find this beyond the pale of reason, that they were doing this, in quote, in the name of safety. Literally, it's our belief as the Senior Federation that the Canadian drug supply is safer than the U.S. drug supply.
Either way, the lawsuit alleges breach of antitrust and consumer protection laws. Nancy Pekarik, a spokeswoman for GlaxoSmithKline, says that the company acted in accordance with current U.S. legislation.
What's important to remember that cross-border trade of pharmaceuticals is illegal, and illegal trade is not protected by the antitrust laws.
On May 7th, this argument was flatly rejected by a Minnesota district judge in response to an ongoing probe of GlaxoSmithKline by Minnesota Attorney General Mike Hatch. Hatch and Minnesota Republican Governor Tim Pawlenty have spearheaded a national movement against current unregulated pricing practices. Drug prices are higher in the United States than elsewhere, says Anita Larson, a spokeswoman for Merck, because U.S. consumers bear the cost of research and development.
We have had a policy for a very long time to oppose price controls because price controls can have the effect of eroding innovation. You need money to put into your pipeline to produce new medicines that make true advances in patients' lives.
A new report by the AARP and the University of Minnesota, described as the most comprehensive study of U.S. brand name wholesale prices ever conducted, was released in early May. Together with a second study, they found that prices for top-selling prescription drugs in the U.S. have increased at 3 to 4 times the rate of inflation, a rate that has accelerated over the past 2 years.
So we have a market system here that doesn't work. You don't have competition.
Peter Wyckoff's Minnesota Senior Federation points out that some of the defendants named in this lawsuit have the highest profit margins of any corporations in the world.
You have over 50% of basic research being funded by the public. You have legalized monopolies on these medications in no effort really by this government or this country to really control the cost of drugs.
If Judge Tunheim awards the lawsuit class action status, any American who has bought prescription drugs in the U.S. that could have been obtained more cheaply in Canada will be eligible for inclusion. With Carrie Byron from KFAI in Minneapolis, this is Kristen Lerstrom for Free Speech Radio News.
Canadians will elect their federal government on June 28th. The long-ruling Liberal Party, the right-wing Conservative Party, the nationalist Bloc Québécois, and the Labour-backed New Democratic Party each described this election as a contest over basic values. Another impending election within the boundaries of Canada also provokes reflection on governance and accountability. The Mohawk community of Ganasitage near Montreal should be going to the polls in elections for their band council in July. And the chief, James Gabriel, is in a fight for his political life amid allegations of corruption. From Ganasitage and Toronto, Kristen Schwartz has the story.
In January, the people of Ganasitage, a community of 1,200, drove James Gabriel out when he attempted to fire the six local police and replace them with a 60-person outside force funded by the federal government. Gabriel's home was burned to the ground. In early May, Gabriel tried again to bring in an outside police force with federal backing, and once again the force was physically prevented from taking control by community patrols that continue to maintain a vigil and to monitor the boundaries of their territory. Gabriel is one of seven elected band council chiefs. John Harding, a former police officer himself and one of three band council chiefs who oppose Gabriel, described that police force at a solidarity rally held in Ganasitage on May 20th.
A lot of these men that are being brought in on that police force have criminal records, are facing criminal charges for assaults, punching women in the face. They are the riffraff that's being sent to Ganasitage to police us in a way that we don't want to be policed in.
Gabriel has said that the conflict within Ganasitage is over crime. He cites a thriving trade in tobacco products sold by merchants who charge no taxes in accordance with treaty rights. Community member Hyongratsani Cree disagrees.
First day was tobacco, then I think it was drugs, then it was organized crime. I was just waiting for the next one, like weapons of mass destruction, you know, in the community, because he tried everything else, you know. It doesn't hold up.
One source of tension in the community is the long simmering land dispute between Ganasitage and the neighboring town of Oka. In 1990, the dispute erupted, and in the standoff that followed, one Quebecois police officer lost his life, and many Mohawks were injured and arrested. 14 years later, the land issues remain unresolved. Furthermore, in 2000, James Gabriel signed a deal with the federal government, which 1 year later was incorporated into law, that Ganasitage's bylaws and land use regulations be harmonized with neighboring non-Native communities. James Gabriel was voted out of office in 2001, but returned after appealing the vote to the federal courts. According to Cree, he's acting on the long-term federal interest in abolishing the special character of First Nations communities and converting them to municipalities.
You know, we always focus on James Gabriel, but he's just one person. He's like, to me, he's a pawn in the whole game. He's just being used by the government, and he's making a lot of money for it. But if it wasn't James Gabriel, it would be somebody else. But behind that, it's the federal government. The ones that want to municipalize this place.
The federal government is certainly backing Gabriel's assertion that elections for the band council, whose mandate runs out on July 14th, must wait until the outside police force is established in the community. Sean Dern is spokesperson for the Federal Department of Public Safety and Security.
The government of Canada, of course, remains committed to having peace and stability in the community, and we believe that that is absolutely necessary before elections can take place.
I understand that Mr. Gabriel is not comfortable with going ahead with elections until the police force is established there. Is that your position as well?
Yes, it is.
But Chief Pearl Bonspiel is determined to go ahead before July 14th.
Well, we're going to have our elections. We're not going to allow anybody to stop the elections, not James Gabriel. At the end of the day, it's the people here who have the democratic right to do that. Not one man will be allowed to decide that.
From CKLN in Ganasitage and Toronto, this is Kristen Schwartz for Free Speech Radio News.
Free Speech Radio News is produced at Pacifica Stations WBAI, KPFA, KPFK, and KPFT. I'm Nell Abram.